All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So our shiur tonight is dedicated by Julia and Leon Sheinman in memory of Julia's grandfather, Yaakov ben Baruch. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, the neshama will have an aliyah and the family a nechama. Also to thank Sharon Levine and family for dedicating the shiur memory of her mother, Rus Bas Avram, on the occasion of her yard site. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, the neshama will have an aliyah and the family a nechama. And all of our shiurim this month are dedicated by Leah Sol, Mezuchus of Rafua Shalema, for her daughter, Ilana Bas Esther. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, Ilana, together with Kol Chole Yisrael, will have a complete and enduring Rafua. And with that, let's begin. So we have the great zchus, the great privilege, to begin Chumash Shmos this week. And although in Chumash Shmos, the stories that generally get the greatest amount of attention are the stories of Moshe Rabbeinu, the emergence of Moshe Rabbeinu is being put on the Nile, Moshe Rabbeinu being collected and essentially being raised in the home of Bas Paro, Moshe Rabbeinu's flight to Midian, finding God, or I should say God finding Moshe. I want to fast forward really towards the end part of the parasha and share with you what I think is an incredibly strange and enigmatic story. If you take a look at number one, let me give you just the background to this. The background is, Mazel Tov, Moshe Rabbeinu was married a wonderful young lady by the name of Tzipora, and they have two sons. Tzipora, again, comes from Yichus. I mean, today Tzipora would never get a shidduch, right? But her father was the high priest in Midian, but she was a very pious and virtuous woman. She marries Moshe Rabbeinu. They have two sons, Gershom and Eliezer. We'll discuss the names in just a little bit. They have two sons after they're living a relatively quiet and tranquil life in Midian. Remember again, Moshe Rabbeinu's life aspirations were, what did he want to be? A shepherd, right? That's all he wanted to be. That's all he ever wanted to be. He never had any greater life aspirations. He did not want to be the leader of Klal Yisrael. He had no intention of ultimately being the voice of God to the people of Israel or to Pharaoh. That was not his life aspiration. If you ask Moshe Rabbeinu what he wanted, the truth is Moshe Rabbeinu wanted what most great people want out of life, which is quiet. Moshe Rabbeinu, Avram Avinu, was not looking for anything big. He was looking for God, but he was not looking to be the founder of a destiny. David HaMelech, we spoke about this last week a little bit, right, was just looking to be a shepherd. Moshe Rabbeinu is fine. He's had enough upheaval in his life. His biological mother has to put him afloat on the Nile at just a couple of months old. He's raised in someone else's home. He's chased out of Egypt. He is more than happy to lead a tranquil life with his in-laws, being a shepherd in Midian. God has other plans, tells Moshe, I'm sorry, a life of tranquility is not in the cards for you. You are going to be the leader of the Jewish people. You are going to be the one who helps them embrace their destiny. The beginning of that destiny occurs in number one. Vayhi baderech b'malon. So you have to imagine the scene. Moshe packs up the family, Tzipora, the boys, and they're going down to Egypt. They were on the way down, and there was an inn, a malon, a hotel, an inn. God meets Moshe Rabbeinu, and God is ready to kill Moshe. Tzipora takes a sharpened stone, she circumcises her son, she takes, it sounds like the foreskin, the mila, casts it at his feet, Ki chasan damim atali. And she says, for you are a bridegroom of blood to me. Vayiref mimenu. He released him. God, it sounds like God released Moshe. Az amra chasan damim lamulos. And then Tzipora again said, a bridegroom of blood concerning the circumcision. What's the obvious question? What is happening here? What is going on? Isn't it amazing that this is in Shmos? This isn't like some esoteric passage or Medrash. This is in the Chumash. We see this story every single year, and it leaves us scratching, what is going on over here? First of all, it sounds like Moshe is about to be killed. Who is he about to be killed by? It sounds like God. And somehow, some way, this is the bris milah then of their younger son, as we'll see. And Tzipora does this bris milah, and somehow it's the bris milah which saves Moshe Rabbeinu from imminent death. So the question we're going to try to analyze over here tonight is what, a very simple question, what's going on? It's a twofold question. Number one, what is the storyline? In other words, what is actually happening in this story? That's question number one. And of course, the follow-up question, which is the same question we ask week in and week out, is what is the lesson for us? Because remember, again, the Torah is not a storybook. And therefore, whenever the Torah does record stories, we are always forced to ask ourselves the simple question, which is, what is the message for us? Stories are only contained because of their moral, ethical, or legal lessons and imperatives. If it's here, it must mean that there's something for us to learn. So let's analyze this. If you take a look at number two, the first approach, we're going to cover three approaches tonight, or four approaches if we have time. So the Rashbam says, very simple, Moshe Rabbeinu is at fault. Moshe Rabbeinu has done something wrong. What did he do wrong? Rashbam number two, Vayit Kesheu Hashem, Ki Haya Misatzel Bahalichoso, Umolich Ishto Ubanov. So what's fascinating over here is as follows. The Rashbam says, I'm going to translate the words and then we'll analyze a little bit deeper. Ki Haya Misatzel. How would you translate the word Misatzel? Lazy, which is a very strong word, right? We'll call it meaning a lack of vigilance or diligence. Moshe Rabbeinu was misatzel. He took a lackadaisical approach to this mission. He took a lackadaisical approach to this mission. How so? He took his wife and he took his children. What does this mean? What is the Rashbam saying? Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake. What was his mistake? Moshe. There's an urgency in this mission. Everyone knows that if you have to get somewhere quickly, what don't you do? Travel with your family. Right? Do not travel with your family. Because as clinical tests have shown, right, if the journey takes X amount of time, if you travel with your family and there are young children involved in that, multiply it by 3. And that's the amount of time it'll take you to get to your destination. So the Rashbam says, Moshe, the Jewish people are suffering. God sends you down to extricate the people from the bonds of servitude. What are you doing packing up the family? Go down to Egypt yourself. This is not for Tzipora. And by the way, I want to point out, did Tzipora and the kids accompany Moshe to Mitzrayim? No. We know, by the way, now we know this in a very strange way. Where do we know this from, that Tzipora and the kids don't make it down to Egypt? We know this because in the beginning of Parshas Yisro, what does the Torah say? Yisro heard all that happened and he comes to meet Moshe. And who does he bring with him when he comes to meet Moshe? Tzipora and the boys. And the Mefarshim said, I don't understand. The last time we heard about Tzipora is here. By the way, this is the last pasuk between now, Chumash Shmos, Parsha Shmos, and Parsha Zisro. This is the last time we hear about Tzipora. This is the last time we hear. The next time we hear about her, she's coming with her father from Midian. So the emphasis is, I don't understand. I just heard Tzipora is going down to Egypt. Now it tells you that Yisro is bringing Tzipora from Midian. And the answer is, she doesn't make it down to Egypt. She and the children do not make it down to Egypt. Moshe ultimately sends her back. Now, why does Moshe send her back? So there's two approaches with this. Either A, the Medrash records a conversation with Aaron. Aaron sees Moshe Rabbeinu coming down with Tzipora and the kids. And Aaron says, Moshe, I think you got the message mixed up. We're trying to get the Jews out of Egypt, right? We're trying to get the people out of Egypt. Don't bring any more people into Egypt. And therefore, Aaron sends them back. Or the other possibility that Moshe Rabbeinu recognizes that the nature of his role, the nature of his destiny, does not include his wife and children. Moshe Rabbeinu is not a family man. Moshe Rabbeinu is a klal man. Moshe Rabbeinu gives up any vestige of personal life for the benefit of the klal. He sends his wife and he sends his children back to her parents. You will not have a life with me. You will not have normalcy with me. Go and establish your life in Midian. So according to the Rashbam, is what's unfolding over here is God is angry with Moshe. Because Moshe Rabbeinu should have embraced his shlichus, should have embraced his agency with alacrity, with eagerness, with zeal. Get to Egypt as quickly as possible. And meanwhile, what's happening over here? Remember, how was the section introduced? Vahi baderach bamalon, which means what? Which means what? The kids got cranky. Nobody wants to travel anymore. So what are they doing? They're checking in to the Holiday Inn Express, right, on the way down to Egypt. That's what's happening over here. So Kasher says, what are you doing? It's not a vacation. This is not a road trip. You are to be the salvation. You are to be the agent of salvation for the Jewish people. Get down to Egypt. This is not about your family. And God is so displeased with Moshe Rabbeinu for what he's doing that what? He stands ready to kill him. Now, this is the approach of the Rashbam. This is the approach of the Chizkuni. This is the approach. If you look at number 5, the Rashbam says again, Vatichros. So now, okay, so according to this version of the story, God is exceptionally angry with Moshe because he feels that Moshe is not acting with enough zeal, alacrity, and eagerness for his mission. Okay, I understand why God's angry. I understand why God's ready to kill Moshe. What I don't understand is what? So what does that have to do with the Bris Milah? Remember again, because the second part of the story is Tzipora circumcises her son, and somehow the circumcision, the Bris, is what saves Moshe. What's the connection? Writes the Rashbam in number 5, Atichros, Ho'ila lo lemoshe ha-mitzvah lehatzilo kimo karb. So really what happens over here? By Tzipora doing the mitzvah of Bris Milah, the zechus, the merit of that mitzvah, saves Moshe Rabbeinu. So according to the Rashbam, this entire story is a dramatic story. What's the message? What's the message? What's the message of the story? Right, first of all, it could be the importance of Bris Milah. Good. What else? Zrizos. When you have to get something done in life, get it done and get it done quickly. We all know, well, maybe not all of you know this, in the group of Nashim Tzidkaniyos, other people know that when you have to accomplish something in life and you don't do it right away, what happens? We know what happens. It doesn't end up getting done. Or even if it ends up getting done, it gets done much later, and it usually doesn't get done in the way it's supposed to get done. If you have something you need to do in life, do not wait. Get it done now. Moshe Rabbeinu's mistake was that God told him to go. He said, sure, I'll go. And what does he do? He saunters down to Egypt. He brings the family with him down to Egypt. Because Rabbeinu says, Moshe, that's not how destiny works. The way destiny works is, you get on your donkey, you get on your camel, you get in your car, you go, you do. There is no time to waste. There is no time to think. There is no time to pack up the family. When destiny calls, you answer it. How many life opportunities do we miss out on because we don't act with zrizos? Because we don't act with alacrity. We assume that our opportunities will be here tomorrow, the next day, a week from now when it's a bit more convenient. And when you don't jump on the opportunities in life, you lose out. You compromise yourself. Moshe Rabbeinu compromised himself because he didn't jump on the opportunity to actualize his destiny. That's approach number one. Take a look at number 6. The Toldos Yitzchak, and you can see I put a little biography over here, says something. This, get ready for this. This is dramatically amazing. Toldos Yitzchak writes, now what's interesting to note, and this is kind of part of the sub-story over here, is that presumably, now the Torah tells us that Tzipora circumcised her son. We would assume that this baby was not what? 8 days old. Right? Why would we assume that? I'm sure Tzipora was a great tzadekes, right? Not that big of a tzadekes, right? She's not traveling with her whole family 8 days after giving birth. So presumably, this child was already older, but yet what? Uncircumcised. So look what the Toldos Yitzchok says. Paragraph 6, Aleph. Ubizos hakdama ne'emar she'tzipor leben harishon shu gershom afa pi shehi goya hershasa lemoshe shiyimol bino. So the Toldos Yitzchak over here quotes a medrash that is jarring. Jarring. The medrash says, Tzipora was a Goya. Goya means what? She was a Gentile. She was a Gentile. Now, by the way, I want to point something amazing out over here. You know, Moshe and Tzipora, presumably during their Shidduch stage, by the well, were not exchanging Divrei Torah. For one simple reason, which is, Tzipora was uninterested. Moshe was a great guy. She was uninterested in his theology. She did not adopt his theology. She did not adopt his religion. She was the daughter of the Midian high priest. And that was her life. Whether she was practicing idolater, not practicing idolater, she was not on the same page as Moshe Rabbeinu religiously. So what happens? Son number one is born, Gershom. Moshe Rabbeinu says, we should circumcise him. Now, again, obviously you have to understand this. For Tzipora, the notion of having her son circumcised is what? Is what? It's barbaric. What are you talking about? But she says, listen, Moshe is circumcised. Moshe Benu was Mahul. It's the firstborn son. Okay, so we'll circumcise the baby. Fine. Aval kisherasa shebeno besakana mitzad amila. So what happens? But then she sees the bris. She sees the bris. And she sees the pain of the little baby. And she hears the cries of the little baby. So what happens? Fast forward a little bit. She has a second son. Says the Toldot HaSichah according to the Medrash. When son number two is born, and Moshe says, no, we should schedule the bris. And Tzipora says, no way. I agree to son number one, because I was a bit naive. I didn't know what this whole Mila thing entailed. Now I saw it. Now I had to deal with the baby. I heard him cry. I had to deal with the recovery afterwards. No bris Mila for the second son. No bris Mila. So what happens? So what happens? Says the Toldot HaSichah. So what should Moshe Rabbeinu's approach should have been? So this is interesting. So the Toldot HaSichah says Moshe Rabbeinu should have circumcised his son anyway. Even if Tzipora didn't consent, he should have gone through with it even without her consent. So what happens? Says the Toldot HaSichah, and this is amazing. Why is God angry at Moshe Rabbeinu? Because Moshe Rabbeinu failed to circumcise his son. The Bris Milah, which is the most basic physical manifestation of the covenant between man and God, and Moshe Rabbeinu was to be the ambassador of God to the Jewish people. His child doesn't have a Milah, doesn't have a Bris. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm sorry, and Kadosh Baruch Hu stands ready to kill him. Therefore, amazingly enough, who saves the day? Who saves the day? Writes the Toldot HaSichah, Vayiv Kasheyu Hashem Vlachin, He Atzma Asasa Ha'Avera, Lakachas Tzor B'mi, He Atzma Asasa Ha'Avera, Lakachas Tzor B'mihirus, Umala Osa Kolkach B'mihirus. So what happens? So Tzipora, who was the one who was reticent to circumcise the child, comes along and what? Does the Bris Milah and saves her husband. So a dramatically different narrative. I'm sorry? It's not complicated, you know. We'll do a PowerPoint next time, right? You know, it's in there. So you know, so she knew how to do it. She knew how to do it. First of all, again, remember she saw the bris milah. Remember, that's not the biggest question in this story over here about how she knew how to do it, right? She watched a YouTube video, right? Whatever it is, right? She saw the first bris milah, so she figured it out, right? So again, understand what's happening over here. The Toldot HaSichah is saying something absolutely amazing, which is again, there is a disconnect between husband and wife. Moshe Rabbeinu is all caught up in this God thing. Tzipora goes along with it for a certain degree. She goes along with the bris milah of the first son. But after she sees what this does, she says, no, thank you. Moshe Rabbeinu should have apparently stood his ground in terms of the theology and religiosity of the family. He doesn't. HaKadosh Baruch Hu stands ready to kill him. Who saves the day? None other than Tzipora. Tzipora, who resisted the concept of Milah, has to be the one who ultimately administers the Milah. Take a look at number 7. The Rosham Shnufal Hirsch says something amazing. But it is not even necessary to go as far as this. We need only to think that Tzipora, who after all was not a daughter of Israel, and at the beginning had possibly not yet completely absorbed all the ideas of Moses, found it hard to allow her child to be circumcised. In the force of circumstances, Moses gave in to a postponement. So you know what happens? Like most good issues that couples disagree with, right? How do we resolve all of our marital issues? We'll talk about it later. You know, let's not deal with it right now. So for that, it's good to see we have incredible biblical precedence for this. Apparently, Moshe and Tzipora did the same thing. She doesn't want to do the bris milah at this time. Moshe says, okay, you know what? You're under a lot of stress. Let's talk about it later. We'll talk about it at a different time. Postponement. So what happens? But not thus was Moshe to come to Egypt. And not thus Tzipora. Not in Midian, but on the journey free from all influence of parents and relatives alone, thrown back entirely on herself, Tzipora is to the soar to the heights of Jewish womanhood. Rav Hirsch understands something dramatic happened over here. Tzipora has to embrace her destiny. Now understand something. We often think of Moshe Rabbeinu having destiny, and we don't think of Tzipora as having destiny. Tzipora had an incredible destiny. It was a destiny of the most Herculean self-sacrifice. Tzipora gives up her husband. Tzipora gives up the father of her children. Tzipora gives up all of the trappings of a normal married life so that her husband has the ability to take care of the klal. Tzipora has to embrace her destiny. Moshe Rabbeinu is embracing his destiny. Moshe Rabbeinu has his embracing destiny moment where? At the burning bush. Right? That was Moshe Rabbeinu's moment of embracing his destiny. Where does Tzipora embrace her destiny? Where does Tzipora opt in to this brand new endeavor of monotheism, of service? Where does she opt in? Where does she opt in? Amazing if it wasn't in Midyan. Because you know something amazing? Something amazing. Sometimes the only way that children embrace their destiny is how? When they leave the nest, when they're far away from the influences of their parents, because whether we like to admit it or not, we all like to think we're good parents, not all of us give the best example or exude the best influence for our children. And sometimes, again, the best parents are the ones who not only allow, but enable their children to move on with their lives. And sometimes it's far away from the home, because that's where you will be able to come your own person. Tzipora is limited in Midyan. Why? Because her parents are idolaters. Because her family are idolaters. Because her sisters are idolaters. Because her friends are idolaters. There is only so far she is going to soar. But take her out of Midyan. Take her out of Midyan. As Rav Hirsch says, she will soar to the heights of Jewish womanhood. Why is she soaring to the heights of Jewish womanhood? Because you know the power of the Jewish woman? She gets done what needs to get done, when it needs to get done, however it can get done. You should write that down, by the way. Right? That's the power of Jewish womanhood. Right? Tzipora says, what does Tzipora know about Bris Milah? How does she know how to give Bris Milah? You know what? When you got to figure it out, you figure it out. And that has always been the koach of the Jewish woman. The Jewish man is very skilled at analyzing, at cogitating, engaging, weighing the issues, and it's fantastic because you could weigh and you could analyze and you get absolutely nothing done. And the koach of the Jewish woman is time to act, time to do. There's a time to think, there's a time to analyze, there's a time to weigh, and there's a time where you use your Jewish woman intuition and you make a decision. Tzipora realizes at this moment, this is her opt-in moment. By the way, it could have been, going back with the narrative, that Moshe Rabbeinu needs some type of schus to save him, could have been another, so she could have taken out a sefer tilim instead of kapitel tilim. Obviously, I'm saying that in jest. She could have done something else. She chooses Bris Milah. Why? Because that was the point of contention with her husband. That was it. She would not allow Bris Milah to occur. And then she realizes, my gosh, for us to actualize our destiny, I have to opt in. How does she opt in? Ultimately, again, through her own personal performance on her son of the mitzvah of Bris Milah. What's the message here? I'm sorry?
Then she has to go back.
For different reasons. She goes back. But she goes back as a Jewess. And by the way, she goes back and she brings her family. Who do you think told Yisrael about everything that was going on? What was Yisrael's pipeline of information that he was so inspired by what God did for the Jewish people? The Medrash was Tzipora. Tzipora was the first Chabadnik. She goes back, ultimately, again, to Midyan. And what is she doing? She's handing out Shabbos candles. Right? She's going in on all seriousness. Meaning, what do you think Tzipora is doing? She opts in, and she goes back. Because Moshe and Tzipora, their lives of destiny are lives of solitary destiny. She has her destiny that is apart from her husband. He has his destiny that is apart from his wife. But also, what's the message here? What's the message here? So I think that there's an incredible message here. That first of all, Tzipora has her moment to opt in. I think what it teaches us is an incredible lesson in terms of building marriage and building mishpacha, which is that to raise an inspired family, and for that matter, to raise an inspired people, husband and wife have to be on the same page. This is an incredibly important idea. Now, I want to be clear. Can you build a successful and loving marriage even with parents on different pages? Sure, absolutely. Can you create an inspired home, an inspired mishpacha? It's challenging. It's challenging. You see, what's happening over here is as follows. For Moshe, we're going to discuss this in greater depth. For Moshe to build an inspired people, inspiration doesn't start out there. Inspiration starts in your home. So Moshe, you're going to inspire people, you're going to build the people. You have to first build your own mishpacha. And we've got a problem. What's the problem? You and Tzipora do not see eye to eye. Now again, I want to be clear that a husband and wife don't see eye to eye. That's beautiful. Meaning, there's a beauty in that. Your spouse is not supposed to be your mirror image. Your spouse is not. This is such an incredible misunderstanding of marriage. People think you're supposed to marry someone like you. No. No. If you want to marry someone like you, I would say it's like a bit narcissistic. Right? You want to marry someone who compliments you. You have weaknesses? You want to marry someone who doesn't have those same weaknesses, who has strengths that offset your weaknesses, and your strengths could offset that person's weakness. Moshe and Tzipora have a marital disconnect, which ultimately leads to a spiritual disconnect. And the Torah HaKadosh is telling us something amazing, that in the moment of incredible tension and stress, Tzipora opts in, and Moshe and Tzipora become a unified couple. And only once they become a unified couple, about how they're going to raise their children and the type of home that they're going to build, even though Moshe is not going to be there to build it with her. She can build it on her own, and he could go down to inspire the people. An incredible and fundamentally fantastic lesson in building the family unit. Parents have to be on the same page in order to build an inspired mishpacha. That's why couples have to discuss, what are your dreams and aspirations for this home? What are your dreams and aspirations for our children? Now, we all know as parents, you could have whatever dreams and aspirations you want for your kids. They're going to dream their own dreams, which is good. But at least in the chinuch, you're going to give them. What's the hadracha? What's the guidance? And if husband and wife are not aligned on that, simple things like the chinuch, what type of education do we want to give our children? What are the most important ruchni lessons we want to give our children? So you'd be surprised, sometimes couples don't discuss this, and they wake up one day and they realize, father wants one thing, mother wants one thing, and when father wants one thing and mother wants one thing, you know what the result of that is? No, there's something. It's called confused children who are receiving contradictory messages because there's not a clear familial hashkafa that is being espoused. Who are we? What are we? What's the home? What are our values? What are our tenets? What's correct? Now again, I want to be clear. There might be many disagreements along that journey, and the disagreements are fine. The disagreements are what force people to refine their life vision, ideas, and ideals. But there has to be unity of purpose between a husband and a wife, between a father and a mother. If there's not unity of ideals, you create a very confused household. And creation of a confused household unfortunately results in confused children. And confused children get themselves into all kinds of trouble during the course of growing up. Message number two, lesson number two from the Toldos Yitzchak, is this was Tzipora's moment when she opts in. You see, what's amazing over here is Moshe can't go down to inspire the people until he's laid the groundwork for leading or creating an inspired home. And the inspired home cannot be created without the Nakaras Habayis, without a Jewish woman at the helm. Tzipora has to opt in order that the home becomes solidified, in order that Moshe Rabbeinu is then able to go on and do the rest of his work vis-a-vis the nation. Another approach. Take a look at number eight. So this is amazing. Rav Hirsch again. Rav Hirsch says something. The same God who had just sent him out with such a great message and on whose mission he was just occupied, suddenly came against him and preferred to let him die. So what Rav Hirsch is pointing out over here is the confluence of events is so bizarre. Remember again, just a few psukim earlier, what was happening. Moshe and God are arguing by the burning bush. God says, you're going down to Egypt to redeem the people. And Moshe says, No. Right? And God says, yes, you are. Moshe says, no, I'm not. And this goes back and forth over and over until God finally says, okay, like it happens with every parent has this type of conversation with their child at some point in time. Let's talk about it. And then at a certain point in time where my kid's not getting it, I say, okay, the conversation's over. Here's how it's going to go. Right? And that's what happens with Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God shuts down the dialogue and tells Moshe this is what's going to go. So after God essentially forces Moshe to assume the mantle of leadership, what happens next? God is ready to kill Moshe in this episode that we're seeing over here, number one. So first says, what's going on over here? You just spent all of this time, literally again, pushing Moshe to accept the mantle of leadership. And even when he refused, you foisted it upon him. Now you're ready to kill him? What's happening here? So first says something amazing. From what follows, it is evident that Moshe had neglected to circumcise his son, and that this was the cause of his life becoming suddenly endangered. Was he not embarked on a mission to accomplish the salvation of a people to whose whole meaning and importance in the world rests on the idea of Milah? And should he, just he, bring in the midst of this people an uncircumcised child? Rather, let him die than let him introduce his mission with such an example. Says of her something amazing. For Moshe Rabbeinu, to show up to Egypt with an uncircumcised child would have been what? The paradigm of hypocrisy. The paradigm of hypocrisy. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, you cannot be a leader if you are a hypocrite. So if I need to kill you and start over with someone else, then I'll start over with someone else. Lesson number three that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching us is a most incredible lesson, which is to be a leader, you have to practice what you preach. And by the way, I want to point out, lest you think that this is just a din or just a concept in national leadership, we're all leaders in different ways. If you have children, you are the leaders of your children. If you're a teacher, you're the leader of your students. We all have leadership positions. You know what the greatest mistake of leaders very often is? Do as I say, not as I do. You know what the greatest mistake that parents make? Do as I say, not as I do. How many times does it happen that parents tell children, this is important, this is important, this is important. There's only one problem, mommy. There's only one problem, daddy, which is, you don't do that. You don't do that. You don't behave that way. You don't dress that way. You don't act that way. You don't conduct yourself that way. It's wonderful that you're telling me that I have to do all of these things, but if it's so important, then why don't you do it? If it's so important. And again, children see through these inconsistencies. Moshe Rabbeinu says, Moshe, listen, you're going to bring an uncircumcised child down into Egypt? Thanks, but no thanks. I'm sorry about the whole misunderstanding by the bush. You're obviously the wrong guy. I'm sorry. You're going to have to meet a very difficult end. I'm going to have to start over with someone else. The incredible message to us is there's room for error. There's always room for error. What is there no room for? Hypocrisy. And this is an incredible yisod. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is totally fine with us being frail and being filled with fault. All God asks us to be is to be genuine and to be honest with who we are and what we're not. Don't be hypocritical. Don't be two-faced. Don't go ahead and project one image to the outside world, but be someone dramatically different on the inside to yourself. Leadership must practice. The leader must practice what he preaches. The leader must be, in the words of Chazal, Tocho Kibaro. That ultimately, again, what's on the outside is reflective of what he truly believes on the inside. And even Moshe Rabbeinu, if there's a shmek, if it smells a little bit like hypocrisy, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm sorry, not interested in it. We could be fault-filled people. We could even be sinful people. All HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks of us is to be genuine people, to not fall into the clutches of life hypocrisy. And finally, we come to our final approach for tonight, which is the Gemara. If you look at number 9, the Gemara says, Tanya. So what's interesting to note over here is as follows. So now it becomes clear, aside from the approach number 1, But it appears to be clear that the issue over here is that Moshe Rabbeinu delayed the milah. He delayed the circumcision of his youngest child. So what we're trying to figure out is why that is. So we've seen the Toldos Yitzchak, who explains this was a result of marital discord with Tzipora. But the Gemara has a different approach. The Gemara says, take a look. Second line, number 9, right after the period. Amar Rebbe, Chas v'shalom shemoshe nisrashal min amila. God forbid that you should say that Moshe was derelict, right? Or was lackadaisical in his performance of Bris Mila. So what happened? So Moshe had the following cheshbon. He said like this, Ela kach amar, emol ve'et sakane. If I give my youngest son a Bris Mila now and go out to the road, you can't travel with a child who is immediately post-circumcision. It's a danger to the child. God wants me to go now. I can't give a Bris Mila then right now. What's my other option? If I give the Bris Mila now, I have to wait 3 days before I travel with my family. Then I can't wait 3 days. Why? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar Li Lech Shuv Mitzrayim. God told me to what? To go. So what does Moshe say? Here's what I'll do. Ela. So Moshe Rabbeinu's cheshbon is a good. So therefore, what the Gemara is saying is like this. So what does Moshe Rabbeinu decide to do? What does he decide to do? Not circumcise the child and go. He figured this was the best cheshbon. God wants me to go down to Egypt. I understand I'll have to delay the milah. Better to delay the milah and heed the word of God than to do the milah and delay the word of God. And I'll figure out the milah later on. So says the Gemara. Sounds like pretty sound reasoning. So why was Moshe Rabbeinu? Why was he punished? So listen to this. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ela Mipnei Man Ne'anash Moshe, second to last line, number 9. Moshe Rabbeinu's logic seems pretty sound. If that's the case, why was he punished? Mipnei Shenis Asek B'malon Tchila. This is amazing. Why was he punished? Because when they stopped to do the bris, he was going to do the bris apparently when he was close to Egypt. When they stopped to do the bris, Moshe Rabbeinu took care of the hotel arrangements prior to the Bris Milah. Apparently what should have happened was, if you stop, do the Bris, we'll figure out the hotel afterwards. Moshe Rabbeinu's mistake is, he made the hotel arrangements first, and then afterwards took care of the Bris Milah. Shene Emar, Mivneshin is Asik B'malon Tchilah. As the Pasuk says, Shene Emar Vahi Baderech B'malon. So this is amazing. So the Gemara says, Moshe Rabbeinu is not being faulted for delaying the milah. I understand he delayed the milah because that was the calculation he made. God told me to go now. If I do the Bris Milah now, I can't go now. So let me go now. I'll do the Bris Milah somewhere on the road. Good calculation, Moshe. What was the mistake? As soon as you stopped, you should have what? Done the milah right then and there and then check into the hotel. The mistake Moshe Rabbeinu made was he checked into the hotel and then did the Bris Milah. So what does this mean? So because of a couple of minutes that Moshe didn't want to check into the hotel, right, get the family settled a little bit, he's punished in such a dramatic way. So I'll show you something amazing. Take a look at number 12. Skip a little bit. So Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. Rav Kuk, in his Sefer Oros HaMishpat, so he says something amazing. Hayaf Shaladun. Skip a little bit. V'amarti bazeh inyan Moshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom shenis asik b'malon tchila. So Rav Kuk quotes the Gemara. What was Moshe Rabbeinu's fault? His fault, right? The mistake he made was that he occupied himself with first making the arrangements of the hotel before doing the Bris Milah. So says Rav Kuk, Moshe, obviously there's a logic to what you did. What was the logic? Hayitachin. Omnam hidur mitzvah la'asos se'uda be'es hamilah, chashav tov la'acher ve'la'asos behidur. So listen to this. Rav Kuk says something absolutely amazing. Why does Moshe Rabbeinu check into the hotel first? Because presumably the hotel had a ballroom, a conference room. So he says, we're going to do a bris. If we're going to do a bris, then what? We should make it beautiful. We should make a se'uda. We should invite the local people. We should make a Kiddush Hashem. We should make it beautiful. We should make it chashev. Moshe Rabbeinu takes care of the hotel first, not because he needs to take a nap and a shower before the Bris Milah, but because ultimately, again, he wants to do the Bris Milah in a more beautiful, magnanimous way. He was checking into the catering facility. All kidding aside, he wanted to make a beautiful su'udah for the... I don't want to do it by the side of the road. I don't just want to do this, just chick-chack over here without any type of fanfare. This is a big mitzvah. This is a big commitment. Especially, by the way, if you understand that Tzipora was reticent to do it. Now she's ready to do it. Let's make it chashiv. Let's make it beautiful. Let's make it significant. Let's make it grand. And so he checks into the hotel to lay the groundwork for the su'udah. V'yish lefarish bazeh, ki chasan damim, haynu shiyaseh su'udah v'simcha. So ultimately, again, the entire purpose of this, says Rav Kook, was Moshe Rabbeinu saying, let's make this as beautiful as possible. So what does Moshe Rabbeinu do? And this is amazing. He delays the performance of the mitzvah in order to do what? In order to do what? To beautify the mitzvah. And says HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe Rabbeinu, when you have opportunities in life, you have to seize them, grab them, actualize them, no matter how imperfect they may be. And don't kick the can down the road because you think you can make it more beautiful later on. Because 9 out of 10 times, when you delay the performance of something because you want to do it better, what usually ends up happening? Not only do you not do it better, but often it doesn't get done at all. The mistake of Moshe Rabbeinu is that he was waiting for perfection. We've spoken about this many times in the past. He was waiting for perfection. He wanted to create the perfect moment for the bris. He wanted to create the beautiful suda. He wanted to create the beautiful surroundings. He wanted to create the beautiful avira, the beautiful atmosphere. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, that's not how life works. You don't wait for the perfect moment, but as we say many times, you make the present moment perfect. Life is never about kicking the can down the road because you think you'll have a better chance at performing it better later on, but rather, seize the moment when it presents itself, even if that moment is highly imperfect. That was the mistake of Moshe Rabbeinu. He should have just stopped. Moshe, your wife's on board. You're ready. You're about to go down to Egypt. You don't know what the day is going to bring. You have an opportunity. Okay, I understand. You couldn't do the Bris Milah a few days ago because you needed to travel. Now you traveled. You're close enough proximity to Egypt. Do it. Do it, do it, do it. Do it right now. Seize the opportunity. Get the job done. Because if you get into a mindset of kicking the can down the road till things are better, till you can do it more perfectly, you're going to delay to the point of inaction. Those who do not seize the imperfect opportunities miss out on all opportunities. We have this self-sabotaging mechanism inside of us that tells us there's a nice opportunity in front of us, but it's not perfect. It's not perfect. So let's wait. Let's wait a little bit, right? Let's wait till tomorrow. Let's wait till the next day, because either something better will come along, or perhaps again, I'll do it better tomorrow. And we know how this works. Anytime you delay in the performance of any life initiative, not only do you usually not make it better, but you usually end up missing out on it in totality. If you take a look at number 13, the Medrash writes, Ushmartem es hamatzos. The Medrash says, you have to guard the matzah, that the matzah shouldn't become chametz. Rabbi Yoshia Omer, al tikri kein ela, ushmartem es hamitzvos. So the Medrash says, don't read it as guard the matzos, but rather it means guard the mitzvos. What does that mean? Kederech she'ein machmitzin es hamatzah. The same way that you cannot let the matzah, you can't let the dough become chametz. By the way, how do you prevent dough from becoming chametz? Right? Either one of two ways. Manipulate it, constantly utilize it, or bake it. Get it done. Get it done. Bake it off. It's done. Kach lo yachmitzu es hamitzvos. Ela im ba'a mitzvah liyadecha, asei osa miyat. An opportunity presents itself, grab it, do it, actualize it. Mitzvah haba liyadecha al tachmitzena. When the opportunity presents itself, don't let it become stale. Don't let it become chametz. When the opportunities of life present themselves, grab them, utilize them, maximize them, actualize them. This was the mistake of Moshe Rabbeinu, and what you see by the according to the scripture of Rav Kook, it was such a beautiful mistake. I know it sounds like a strange thing to say. Why was it such a beautiful mistake? Because what does Moshe Rabbeinu want to do? What does he want to do? He wants to perform the mitzvah with greater hidur. He wants to perform the mitzvah with greater beauty. He doesn't want to just do it on the side of the road. He wants to mamish, make it magnificent, meaningful, holy. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Moshe, you are not just a man. You modeled the correct behavior for everyone. And if you wait, and you know what happens when you check into the hotel? Maybe your room's not ready. Maybe the ballroom's not ready. You know, check-in is at 3, you know, Mr. Rabbeinu, but you know, you're here at 2 o'clock. We could see housekeeping is there. There's a whole bunch of delays that's set in life. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, you have to model the right kind of zrizos. You have to model, this kind of ties back a little bit into the first approach. You have to model the right kind of alacrity. You see, whereas the first approach, really 1 and 4 are very much linked. Because remember, the first approach was the Rashbam. The Moshe was being faulted for what? What was he being faulted for? Bringing the whole family down, right? Just go, just move. Approach number 4 says, okay, you want to bring the family, that's fine, beautiful. But Moshe, when you now have the opportunity to do the mitzvah, do it. Do it. And this is such an incredible life lesson. Life presents us with opportunities, bless you, all of the time. And I have a choice. The choice is, get the job done. The choice is, do it. Or, if I'm not going to do it, don't fool yourself and say you'll get to it later, because chances are, I don't usually get to the, you know, there's a Mishnah of us. Al tomer l'chesha efna eshna, shema lo tipana. Don't say that when you have time, you will learn. Why? You're not going to have time. I was, I'm not going to have time. Sure, I'm going to have time. One day I'm going to be retired, I'm living in Boca, and it's going to be fantastic. So I'll have plenty of time. No, because life has a way of getting busy with a whole bunch of other things as well. And therefore, again, if opportunity presents itself, grab it, take it. Because obviously, life is all about seizing the right opportunities and letting the not right opportunities pass me by. So if we bring this all together, it turns out that from this exceptionally enigmatic episode, we learn some incredibly profound and overwhelming life lessons. We learn, number one, that there has to be a unity in mission and a unity in purpose between husband and wife. Husband and wife don't have to agree on all things, but they do have to agree on the mission statement of their home. They have to agree on the mission statement of their mishpacha. They have to agree ultimately again on who they want to be and how they want to raise their children, the type of home they want to create. That's lesson number one, unity of vision between husband and wife. Lesson number two is that to lead, you can be filled with faults, but you must divest yourself of all hypocrisy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is more than happy to tolerate our shortcomings, our sinful behavior, our deficits, and the things that are broken. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't deal with is hypocrisy. We cannot go ahead and preach one thing and do something different. We cannot give the message of do as I say and not as I do. And even a Moshe Rabbeinu, as great as you are, if you think you're coming into Mitzrayim with an uncircumcised child, when the Bris Mila itself represents the epitome, ultimately again, of obedience and commitment and relationship with God, sorry Moshe, then you're not genuine. Then you're being a bit hypocritical, and if you're hypocritical, you're not the right man for the job. We have to check ourselves for hypocrisy. We have to make sure that that which we espouse as our beliefs, we spoke on this a few weeks ago, it's not just enough to espouse your beliefs. You have to make sure that your belief system is manifest in the way that you live. We're very good in speaking about our hashkafas. This is my hashkafa. This is what I believe. Fantastic. More important than what you believe in is how you live those very beliefs. When I say one thing but live a different way, then unfortunately, that's not a fault or a shortcoming. Unfortunately, that's hypocrisy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could tolerate everything, just doesn't want us to be hypocritical. And finally, the last lesson, which is the combination of approaches number 1 and number 4, that the fundamental failure of Moshe Rabbeinu was a failure of zrizos, a failure of alacrity. But again, it stemmed from such a beautiful and holy place. Moshe Rabbeinu stood ready to do the mitzvah. He just wanted to do it in the most beautiful way possible. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for whatever reason, felt that that was not the time. See, there is a concept of hiddur mitzvah. There is a concept of taking the time sometimes to beautify mitzvah, to make it more grand, even though it takes a little bit longer, a bit more resources, a bit more time. Moshe Rabbeinu over here, on one hand, needs to get down to Egypt, and on the other hand, needs to go ahead and perform this mitzvah. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, Moshe, your mission at this moment is to teach people that when opportunity presents itself, even when it is an imperfect opportunity, if it's the opportunity you have, then grab it, take it, maximize it, actualize it. If you wait in life for the perfect moment, then what happens? What happens to those who wait for the perfect moments? Right? You do one thing very well, which is wait. And you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. But if you don't need perfection out of your moments, but you're willing to seize even the imperfect moments, life is filled with incredible, beautiful, and dramatic opportunities. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was teaching Moshe Rabbeinu a very important lesson. Because this is a story, Shmos is a story of Geula, of redemption. And you see, part of the frustration of Moshe Rabbeinu is he thought, how was salvation going to unfold? What were Moshe Rabbeinu's expectations for this process? What was his expectations? He was going to roll into Egypt, tell Pharaoh, I'm here from God, let my people go. And Pharaoh was going to say, okay. Right? Okay, when do you guys want to leave? You know, can I pack your lunch? Right? That was Moshe Rabbeinu's expectation. Even though God told him it's not going to be that way. Shmos says to Moshe, that's not how life works. Life is never perfect. Life never goes according to plan. The opportunities are never come and run up to your feet and lay down at your feet, right? And wait for you to be ready. That's not the way life works. Life is filled with opportunities. 99.999% of them, imperfect and highly flawed. And life is all about finding the courage to stop waiting for perfection. Stop waiting for the perfect moment. And find the strength and the ability to seize the moment in front of you, no matter how imperfect it may be. All right, we'll stop over here for tonight.